ABCs of NMOSD is an education podcast series to share knowledge about neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder, or NMOSD, a rare relapsing autoimmune disorder that preferentially causes inflammation in the optic nerves and spinal cord. ABCs of NMOSD podcast series is hosted by SRNA, the Siegel Rare Neuroimmune Association, and in collaboration with the Sumaira Foundation for NMO, the Connor B. Judge Foundation, and Guthy Jackson Charitable Foundation. This education series is made possible through a patient education grant from Horizon Therapeutics. Hello and welcome to the ABCs of NMOSD podcast series. ABCs of NMOSD is made possible through a patient education grant from Horizon Therapeutics. Horizon is focused on the discovery, development, and commercialization of medicines that address critical needs for people impacted by rare, autoimmune, and severe inflammatory diseases. They apply scientific expertise and courage to bring clinically meaningful therapies to patients. Horizon believes science and compassion must work together to transform lives. My name is Rebecca Whitney from the Siegel Rare Neuroimmune Association, and I recently had a conversation with Drs. Jane Nuss and Sylvia Tenenbaum on pediatric NMOSD history and diagnosis. Dr. Jane Nuss is professor of pediatric neurology at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, or UAB. She has directed the UAB Center for Pediatric Onset Demyelinating Disease since its founding in 2006. The center is based at Children's of Alabama, the children's hospital adjacent to UAB's medical center. Dr. Nuss has been involved in clinical trials for pediatric NMOSD, and she is especially interested in long-term outcomes of children and adolescents with demyelinating disease. Dr. Sylvia Tenenbaum is a pediatric neurologist who received her MD with honors from the University of Buenos Aires and acquired further training and certification in pediatric neurology in Argentina. She serves as associate professor and chief of clinics at the Department of Neurology, National Pediatric Hospital, Dr. J. Garahan, a tertiary referral pediatric hospital in Buenos Aires, Argentina. Dr. Tenenbaum is the director of the Pediatric Neuroimmunology Program at the same institution. She has had a long-standing interest in a wide range of CNS neuroimmune disorders with pediatric onset and has established a comprehensive care clinic for children and adolescents with multiple sclerosis, neuromyelitis optica, acute disseminated encephalomyelitis, MOG antibody-associated disease, autoimmune encephalitis, and related disorders. Her research interest focuses on the identification of novel biomarkers of autoimmune neurological disorders in children, the identification of clinical and neuroimaging characteristics of pediatric multiple sclerosis and autoimmune disorders targeting AQP4 and MOG antibodies, and optimizing treatment approaches for children with these diseases.
Welcome, Dr. Nuss and Dr. Tenenbaum. And thank you for joining us today. We are here to discuss the pediatric NMOSD. Dr. Nuss, if you want to start us off with just a brief history of NMOSD in children, maybe when was it first recognized in kids?
I think that we have not recognized it in children as early as we did in adults. And then in adults, NMOSD was recognized in the mid-1800s. I'm not going to have the exact date, Sylvia, if you've got it there, but and then it was, you know, identified by Dr. DeVick, and actually I believe it was his student, as being the combination of both eye and brain involvement. And the first case in children, I'm actually not entirely sure when the first case in childhood was. I think it was in the mid-1800s. 1960s, but I'm going to, Sylvia, do you know for sure? That's one part I didn't get looked up.
I looked for that and I found that the first published case was in 1995. And actually that was a young girl aged 11, described as a pediatric MS, previously diagnosed as having ADM. But looking at the images and the clinical phenotypes of relapses, this young girl had NMOSD. So the title of the paper was a pediatric MS case previously diagnosed as ADN, but actually that was an NMOSD case. And in 2000, there was an additional pediatric case at 4 years of age from Rabat, Morocco. But I have had a look to Jock Murray's book, Multiple Sclerosis, The History of the Disease. And there was the story of Lidwina of Schiedam in Holland that was considered the first MS case. That was a pediatric case in a young girl of 16 years. And I'm sure that was an NMOSD case because she started with a spinal cord involvement, left her with a paraparesis with a severe spasticity. And after that, some episodes of visual loss, so optic neuritis involvement, but with no recover. She was blind in one of the eyes. And that's not the typical evolution of the optic nerve involvement in an MS patient. So I think that Lidwina of Schiedam, Holland, is the first pediatric case. And that was exactly 1380.
Wow.
Yeah. I think a number of cases that we, you know, have called quote, quote, ADM or quote, quote, you know, then MS when we finally felt brave enough to call kids with MS, I think in retrospect have been re-diagnosed as NMO.
But I think it's evident that many pediatric neurologists around the world before those first published cases, including me in Argentina and Jane in Alabama, United States, were diagnosing and we were treating children with a clinical picture resembling something that adult patients had, like NMOSD, although we are not publishing those cases, but we were discussing experiences in the meetings with expert colleagues, and we were treating those kids as if they were NMO. Later, we have the opportunity to request for the NMO IgG test in serum and confirm if those cases have actually the antibody positivity. The first published characterization on NMOSD IgG seroprevalence in pediatric patients was published in 2008. There was a paper we wrote with Brenda Banwell, where 87 pediatric patients and Dr. Vanda Lennon offered to test all these kids. Most of them were from Buenos Aires. 13 NMO patients were included, in addition to 13 patients with optic neuritis, 13 with transformyelitis, 3 ADM patients with longitudinal extensive transformyelitis, and 41 MS cases. And Dr. Vanda Lennon blinded, tested all of them with the test she had just discovered. And 7 out of the 9 NMOSD patients who were relapsing, showing relapsing disorder, were positive for the test. And some of the optic neuritis patients as well, and a single patient with the transformyelitis, none of the pediatric MS patient. So that was the first published characterization, published in a cohort of children with NMO with the Mayo Clinic, with Vanda Lennon performing herself the test in those kids. That was a wonderful experience.
Thank you very much.
That was a seminal paper.
And how common is it to see NMOSD in children? And how does it compare to the other rare neuroimmune disorders like TM, ADEM, MOG that we are now aware of? And also as compared to pediatric MS? Dr. Ness, go ahead.
So that is actually something I did actually look up ahead of time. That is there. I think one of the nice papers looks at, there's papers from Denmark, Korea, Taiwan, Germany, Austria, and then many of these are also reviewed by Dr. Tenenbaum and Dr. Ye that they just published this paper that, you know, the incidence ranges from, you know, 0.05 to 4 per 100,000 patient years or per year. And the prevalence is 0.5 to 4 0.4 per 100,000, actually be patient years. And we're in comparison, MS, you know, in some of the papers we looked at, some of the, in other specific studies, for example, in Denmark can be, MS can be 5 times more common, 5 to 10 times more common. So they're rare. I mean, very, you know, one per 100,000 person years, but it can be, you know, if you've evolved, you know, would be a sort of max of, you know, MS or even a half of that. And then children are, you know, children with NMOSD are perhaps a fifth of that. So we're really talking one, do the math, you know, 1 in 1,000,000, 1 in 500,000. Sylvia, am I done my math right?
No, I think that there is a difference if we compare North America, for example, with South America. So there is a race difference. That's the reason that, yeah, in the Canadian cohort of Brenda, there were only 3 NMOSD cases, and the rest, the 17, were from Argentina. So the disorder is much frequent here in South America because we are not Caucasian. We have an European ancestry, but with a mixture with natives, so we are mestizos, with a rather more darkened skin. And in Brazil, for example, more black population than in Argentina, so it's even more frequent in Brazil than in Argentina. But generalizing, in South America, there is more prevalent than in North America, because this is exceptionally seen in Caucasian NMOSD. Is more frequent in mestizos or black population and in Asian population. That's the high frequency in Japan and South Korea. Okay. So I think that we cannot give a fixed number if we not related that number with the geographic location of the cohort, for example. In my pediatric cohort, I work in a pediatric hospital, NMOSD patients are 3 to 1 compared with the MS patient, is less frequent multiple sclerosis, is more frequent NMOSD. That's interesting. I think it's a different ratio in North America, for example, Canada or United States.
Can I have you, so did you just say that it was 3 to 1, it was 3 MS to 1 NMOSD way around? Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Okay, I just wanted, because again, that is striking. And again, I would say that so in our population that's from Alabama, that's about 25% African-American across the South, that are the number that, you know, we probably have 2 MS to 1 NMOSD. If you have the whole spectrum, you know, that fulfills the 2015 criteria. You know, so it's still more MS, but it's, you know, NMOSD is not as rare as everybody tells us it is. And certainly it's more in African Americans.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Thank you. Moving on to some of the diagnostic information related to NMOSD, as far as what you may see on the imaging, what you find in your clinic exams, and also pathologic findings, what we do through the different tests. Do you find that they're different in children than what is in adults? Does it differ by age of the child? If it's a very young child with longitudinally extensive transverse myelitis versus a 13-year-old who may have an onset of optic neuritis, can you talk a little bit about that?
So first of all, for full disclosure, that I see only children, you know, we see them up until 18. And so I really have limited adult experiences since I've completed my training. I mean, we certainly, you know, meet with our adult neurologists and have conferences. So I'm not, you know, I'm not going to have the clinical experience to answer that smartly. But the presentation, I think, often in younger children can include more encephalopathy than the older, than the, you know, even, you know, teenagers and certainly adults. And I think that can make it really challenging to under, you know, especially a very young child who may be encephalopathic, or are they just, you know, do they hurt? You know, are they, you know, that they can't communicate to you can be very hard to identify. Even where all the lesions are. I mean, one of the things I trained our residents is that, you know, I mean, if you suspect demyelination, you have to scan from stem to stern, because you may have silent optic nerve lesions because a child can't tell you that they can't see. Or they may have, we've certainly identified kids with spinal cord lesions that fulfilled criteria for neuromyelitis optica, but, you know, they weren't moving much in bed, and they were, you know, it was, I don't think anybody would have necessarily identified them initially as having a cord lesion if, you know, because they were just so irritable and didn't feel good. So I think it's the age that often makes it more challenging.
And how about you, Dr. Tenenbaum? Do you have some experience with adults that you would like to speak?
No, because I work in a pediatric hospital, the same as Jane, but I learn from the adult colleagues, showing in the meetings, the experience in adults and the publications. And what we saw in the paper I mentioned with Brenda Banwell, and what I'm seeing now with evaluating all my pediatric cohort, that the single most useful diagnostic feature associated with NMOSD in an adult patient, and which I the distinction from MS, is the longitudinal, a long involvement in the spinal cord. And that is less predictive for NMOSD in children than in adults.
Okay.
Because more frequently they start with an encephalopathic picture, like Jane described, or with an optic neuritis, uni or bilateral involvement of the optic nerves. Okay. And only when they grow up, they may show the typical longitudinal spinal cord involvement or within the relapses, or showing that when they suffered from relapses of the disorder. It's different from the other biomarker, which is the MOG IgG, mm-hmm. myelin oligodendrocyte glycoprotein, that in a small number of children may develop a disorder resembling NMOSD. So the brain involvement is more frequent, particularly in the younger patients, more frequent than in AQP4 IgG positivity.
And are children more likely to be AQP4 positive NMOSD versus AQP4 negative? Do you see a difference there?
In my experience, they're very more frequent, the seronegative for AQP4. It's exceptional that children with NMOSD fulfilling of the diagnostic criteria to be AQP4 seropositive. I think it's less than 8 to 10% of my cohort. So it's more frequent that they are seronegative, and probably 60% of those seronegative are MOG.
Okay.
But there is still a good number of children with double seronegative results. And I think that's amazing, because there's still some autoantibodies that are waiting to be discovered.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's different from adults. Adults, 90% of NMOSD fulfilling 2015 diagnostic criteria will be seropositive for AQP4 IgG antibodies. And that's not the finding we have in children. That's a striking difference.
I want to ask a question is how many, and this may be preempting what you were going to ask, is how many children end up seroconverting after initially, in your experience, after initially being negative? Do you have many that have seroconverted later, you know, if they were pre-pubertal and then later in puberty?
I have none patient seroconverting from seronegative to seropositive for AQP4. And I have two or three children starting seronegative for MOG and becoming seropositive after the second or third relapse. Those who were seronegative from the start to AQP4 IgG antibody still were seronegative during the follow-up, even having suffering from relapses.
Interesting, because we've experienced the same with the NMOS for the aquaporin 4 antibody that I haven't had anybody seroconvert. But I've also wondered because some of these children I have on rituximab. And so I don't entirely trust that result.
You are absolutely correct. After statin immunosuppression, I don't test anymore the antibody. Right. Because I'm not going to get a positive result or useful result. You are absolutely correct.
Although interestingly, when the MOG antibody became more widely commercially available for Mayo, I did have patients who were, seronegative, if you could see me do my air quotes, and then ended up becoming, but were found to be MOG positive. So rituximab doesn't wipe out all the MOG, but I've seen it wipe out aquaporin 4.
Interesting. Good to know. That was a question I did have listed, is if those immunosuppressant therapies do impact levels of the antibodies. So thank you very much for bringing that up. Is there a general age range for when NMOSD is diagnosed in children? Can it happen in an infant? Are there known triggers that may be that initial attack in NMO? And I know we talked a little bit about race and ethnicity and that being a factor in the number of NMOSD diagnoses. Are there other possible predispositions to a child having NMOSD, like a family history of autoimmune issues or MS? Dr. Ness, do you want to start us off on that one?
So there is some data from the U.S. network that children with autoimmune demyelinating disorders, including NMO, have a higher frequency of family members with autoimmune disorders, not necessarily all demyelinating, but can also have, some family history of lupus. That's probably the one that I see the most frequently. So there is definitely some genetic predisposition. There is probably, certainly in MS, there's talk about the Epstein-Barr virus, history of having had that, to the point that if a child is negative for the Epstein-Barr virus, it's almost something that you need to think about, is there something else than MS? And then there's a question of, are there preceding, what people worry about immunizations? We haven't seen anything in our own group that really specifically acts as a trigger that I've been able to associate, these are small numbers, so it's hard to, but I don't think that, immunization sounds pretty reassuring. That's often, is there other viral triggers? But certainly, I think, there is probably your genetic and, ethnicity is probably your biggest predisposition, but we're still talking about an extraordinarily rare disease that, on the back of the napkin numbers and even when there's, are in good epidemiologic studies, far less than 1 in 100, one in a million.
And as far as when you are seeing this come up in children, what age does it typically happen? What do you see? Dr. Tenenbaum, what is your experience with diagnosing?
The beginning of the disorder is more frequent around the age of from 10 to 14 years of age, probably. That's the interval where most cases are being seen. And looking for the youngest, it was 18 months of age, a single one. And after that, we're 21 months, probably 3 or 4 kids. And above the age of 2, more frequent. But I think the peak is between 10 and 14. Under that age, there is the same prevalence looking at girls and boys. And in adolescents, of course, puberal patients is more frequent in girls.
Agree. The peripubertal age, that 11, 12, 13, yeah, is really prime for developing NMO. And the older than that, it tends to be MS. Younger than that, it tends to be ADEM.
Exactly.
And the MOGs we're still figuring out.
We're still trying to get to the bottom of that, yes.
And for adult patients, a female sex is the strongest risk factor. So
yes,
that's strong, the female predominance, that the female sex is the more powerful risk factor. It's amazing.
Yeah, post-pubertal. I mean, there's a very strong change after, in our post-pubertal kids. And I would also say that, and for us, ethnicity, that NMOSD is more common in our African American patients. And I think that is that, yeah, in our older patients are even more strong, you know, like 90%.
Thank you very much. And as you're seeing these children, as they present with the symptoms of any of these rare neuroimmune disorders, what are some of the differentiating characteristics that you may look for, whether it's in imaging? Obviously, we do have the AQP4 antibody that we can test for, but how else are you differentiating between the ADEM, the TM, and the MOG for a child with NMO?
Well, we are making a mixture between what are syndromes or presenting syndromes, which are signs and symptoms that a child might present at the first event, with final category diagnostic, which is ADM or MS or NMOSD. So at the beginning, optic neuritis is not a diagnosis. It's just referring to the involvement of the optic nerves with something that may be inflammatory. The same for the spinal cord involvement. We name transformyelitis. And the same for an acute encephalopathy with something in the brain MRI. And we named that an ADM, an acute disseminated encephalomyelitis. Those are just syndromes and may reflect different diseases. So brain MRI is quite different in a kid with multiple sclerosis compared with the findings you may see in a kid with NMOSD due to AQP4 IgG antibodies or brain involvement in a MOGAD, so in a more antibody-associated disease. Very different, so more inflammatory, large in the AQP4 and more in the immune-mediated disorders, and smaller and with very clean borders, very well-defined borders, with a location periventricular in the MS group. So the brain MRI may be very helpful to think different things. Optic nerves, very different. More frequently, there are bilateral involvement, kids, loss of the visual acuity, first in one eye and very quickly in the other eye, or simultaneously bilateral, that's more frequent in AQP4 and MOG, and it's exceptional in MS. In MS, it's more frequent, the involvement of a single eye, only one eye, and the MRI is very different as well. In the AQP4 IgG, you may look at the chiasma, the posterior part, when the optic nerve is emerging, going to the orbit, and there may be the involvement of the AQP4 IgG antibodies. And in more IgG-mediated disorders, you are going to see more an anterior involvement of the optic nerves. And in the fundoscopy, you will see the edema of the papilla. And this is very exceptional in an MS case. So the immune-mediated disorders, AQP4 or MOG, are quite different from the brain MRI or the orbital MRI from the kids having or suffering from multiple sclerosis. And looking at the spinal cord, the difference is great because in MOG or AQP4 IgG, you are going to see longitudinal extensive spinal cord involvement. So more than 3, 4, or 5 spinal segments with a huge inflammation. And in multiple sclerosis, it's the same as in the adults with multiple sclerosis, you will see a short spinal cord involvement, no more than 1 or 2 spinal segments. That's a huge difference. Mm-hmm. And looking at the difference between AQP4 and MOG, children with MOG more frequently have bladder control involvement and may be left with neurogenic bladder because the conus is usually involved in the MRI. And that is not so frequent for AQP4. On the contrary, in AQP4, you will see most cervical, upper cervical involvement going into the medulla. So the vomiting and nausea or hiccups is another frequent clinical presentation in teenager or adult patients with AQP4 IgG and NMOSD. This is the area postrema syndrome. And it's exceptional in MOG and very frequent and suggestive of the diagnosis of NMOSD with AQP4 IgG antibodies. So you can see the pros and cons from the MRI, the clinical point of view, between the three disorders. NMOSD with IgG4 IgG antibodies, MOGAD, the spectrum of MOG antibodies, and multiple sclerosis. Very helpful to differentiate the three. In addition to, may be able to differentiate from sarcoidosis, lupus with spinal cord involvement, infectious conditions involving optic nerve or spinal cord. In children, we have a wide range of differential diagnoses, and we are forced to go across all that list of differential diagnoses to get the final diagnosis of an autoimmune disorder or immune-mediated disorder, allowing us to start an immunotherapy.
I agree with you completely, Sylvia. That's a very similar, you get this feeling for them. Although I think the other thing I would like to add is that seeing that clinical outcome over time, I mean, just even after the first attack is, so a child who has a pretty fixed visual loss is often going to be an aquaporin 4 positive. And so that will often be an important clue to, just how the optic neuritis is much more severe. And then, follow-up of the lesions, both the aquaporin 4 and the MOG positive, MRI lesions will, be big and fluffy and look horrible, and then will often resolve, where the MS lesions, you're not going to, you're going to have something, you're not going to lose all your spots.
Thank you so much. Yeah. And with the AQP4, and we touched on this a little bit earlier, but if they are negative, you're typically not retesting for that later, especially if they are on immunosuppressant therapy, or are you testing for that? And if so, at what time would you test again? And if they are positive, do you continue to do follow-up tests for that? And are there the possibilities that a child can test positive for both the AQP4 antibody as well as the MOG antibody?
So I think first, now we test for both after both MOG and aquaporin 4 after the first attack. And I will, repeat a year later for both if they're negative. And then I'd like to try and repeat after puberty. And then, of course, if it's a child who's put on rituximab, my hopes, are low. But I try to at least get, if it's a prepubertal child, I try and check later. Once they're positive for aquaporin 4, I have not been repeating the titers. I don't find them helpful. And I'd also like to mention, we're only looking in serum, not in CSF. I think, our residency, in trying to be really complete, we'll try and get it from everything. So only get it from serum. And if they're positive for NMOSD, I stop checking. With MOG, I'm still a little bit on the fence about how to manage this. There are people who are checking every 6 months. I'll try and check every year or so just to see where they're going. There's some people who say, it's helpful following them over time. And I am waiting for more data. I'm on the fence about that. Sylvia, how do you manage these positive or negative antibodies?
Okay. Unfortunately, when we receive a patient with the acute event, we have not the results very quickly. So we have to manage the patients and knowing the real serostatus of the patient. So we focus on the acute therapy, trying to recover the patient as much as possible. We use a lot of plasma exchange, particularly if there is a severe spinal cord or optic nerve involvement. First steroids, and after that, plasma exchange directly.
Yes.
If I have a more or less quick result with an AQP4 IgG positivity, the child after the plasma exchange is going to start directly with immunosuppression, because AQP4 IgG positivity is indicating a relapsing disorder, a severe relapsing disorder. So if I have that result and I could recover the neurological deficit after plasma exchange, I am forced to start immunosuppression right away. So I started with rituximab soon after the first clinical event. As Jane mentioned, it's not the same for MOG antibodies because most children started to decrease the titer in serum after the first event. If they are seropositive, they may show the decrease of those antibodies between 12, 18, or 24 months. So many children may stay or remain as monophasic disorder or disease, and there is no need to start immunosuppression. And very frequently, if they are going to have a relapse in disease, they may show an increase again of the antibodies many years after the first event. So there is a tricky, the MOG antibodies. So after the first event, I never start immunosuppression. Maybe I may prolong or give the oral steroids for 3 or 4 months, and after that to take them away and wait and see what happened. If they relapse, even not knowing if they have again seropositive MOG antibodies or seronegative, I should start immunosuppression, with exception of the relapsing forms of ADM, because ADM is frequently the first event in the young children with MOGAD. The more frequent relapse phenotype is optic neuritis after the first ADM, that is named ADM on, or multiphasic DEM. Most of the multiphasic DEM are MOG positive. And probably there is no going on a third clinical event or a fourth. No, children have the second clinical, the first relapse, and nothing else. So I would be careful with that relapsing subtypes. But the rest, relapsing optic neuritis, relapsing spinal cord involvement, fulfilling NMOSD criteria, looking at the clinical and MRI phenotypes of relapses, all those MOGAD patients should start immunosuppression. After you start immunosuppression, there is no way to test for the antibodies in serum because you have a great chance of have a negative result. Mm-hmm. So I don't request that test after starting immunosuppression. Mm-hmm. Because if that's for a decided treatment, if I had decided to start rituximab, no way, okay.
So Sylvia, how often are you checking MOG antibodies?
In every kid with an optic neuritis, with a spinal cord involvement, with a brainstem syndrome, with ADM.
But at the beginning, absolutely, everybody's getting MOG. Yeah. Because that's the most common positive antibody that we get back in our population. But once it's positive, how often are you following MOG antibody titers?
If it is positive, I follow by clinical and MRI. If there is no relapse, 1, 2, 3 years after the first event, I don't check again the MOG.
Okay.
I'm more confident of the clinical and the MRI evolution than the test. In addition, in my hospital, they are not free. Patients have to pay for the MOG because it's laboratories outside my hospital, and it's a very expensive study. Here is Latin America, it's different. We are happy that we have one private institution that performed the test. Many countries in Latin America are not available to this kind of laboratory studies. That is difficult that we have in Latin America. And I think that many other countries in the world. So there is not so frequent that you have access to, in particular with MOG, to the best assay, which is the cell-based assay. That is exceptional. Sure. Because many countries have the commercial kit for MOG, and you don't have titles in that way. And you may have done some wrong or false positive. And that's another problem.
Well, I appreciate that. So there's kids who have access to, you know, we have access to insurance, or in Alabama, they're pretty well insured. But even then, it's, you know, thinking about, you know, how often, you know, do we need to get these MOG titers? And I've actually, my practice is very similar to yours, is I don't chase it. And, you know, I follow the, you know, clinical course in MRI. And then I'm also a little skeptical about, you know, the titers being able to predict the future, because certainly I've had patients whose titers have gone down and then they've still come around and had a relapse, and their titer may go up, you know, 1 to 40 to 1 to 100. But it isn't like there's major, you know, there's a big change in their titers once they're positive. I think that's something we're still figuring out. But I'm with you. I don't think we need to be driving ourselves nuts chasing them.
Exactly. I absolutely agree. There is no way to continue testing. There are 2 or 3 very good papers showing the behavior of those titles on time, because they were funding, funding studies. But I don't think they are very useful in the clinical practice, in the real world. World, I think it's more useful to carefully follow your children, your patients, from the clinical point of view, examining what is new in the clinical examination. I follow them every 3 months and requesting a new MRI every 6 months to see if there is any sign of inflammation that I couldn't check in the physical examination, and checking the laboratory every 6 months, looking for some index of inflammation in the blood. So I'm confident with that follow-up. If I have a new relapse and I have the opportunity to check again the MOG antibodies, I'm going to do it. But anyway, I'm going to start immunosuppression. Because seronegative or seropositive, if they have a relapsing disease, they need treatment. They need chronic immunotherapy.
For the MOG patients, how long will you treat? I might be jumping ahead. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to be the person who's asking the questions, but this is a fun clinical discussion.
Absolutely. And that's the way we are all growing in our knowledge, changing, our experience. I will say in the last 5 or 10 years, I was very afraid to interrupt the immunosuppression after the patients were quite stable. But after the experience in Europe, the group for Denmark, I think, that they start taking out the immunosuppression after 2 years of a very stable clinical and MRI disease. And so I started to do so, and they are doing quite well. If during 2 years under immunosuppression, a MOGAD patient is showing no relapses, stable clinical examination, and in the middle 3 or 4 MRIs without any acute inflammatory sign, you may start de-escalating the treatment, and maybe I will give the infusion longer periods or leaving the patient to increase the CD19 up to 3 or 4, looking for the new MRI. If there is nothing there after 2 or 3 years with a stable disease, I stop the infusions and wait and see. It's not the same for AQP4. In AQP4, I'm not
absolutely
that experience. Absolutely not.
And that would be similar. We tell our MOG patients, we'll sign you up for 2 years, and then and this isn't and again the MOG children who have relapsed, not the the one time they're positive. About half of our kids have had a relapse, and half of our kids have not had a relapse with MOG. And with a NMOSD, they're all going to relapse eventually.
Exactly.
And so, excuse me, it's Aquaporin for NMOSD.
Yeah.
Yes, that was actually one of my questions that was coming up. Is it something that they could eventually grow out of? But so a child with the AQP4 with NMOSD, that is a lifelong diagnosis.
What we know today is for life.
Okay. Yes, that's until a cure comes along, which, with the support of, what's happened with Guthy Jackson, 3 approved drugs. And I think the sky is the limit. And I hope in my patient's lifetime, maybe not in mine, that there will be a cure for Aquaporin 4 NMSD. But, the disability in the Aquaporin 4 patients is really driven by relapses. And so the goal is to prevent relapses at all costs, because, that's what can be devastating. My sense is that the MOG patients recover better, even with a scary looking MRI in the beginning. Although I think, I've certainly seen MOG positive patients with incomplete recoveries. I've also seen MOGs also separated out, some have had, in events and then develop events later on. Although these are kids who, we don't know what their MOG titer was at the beginning of their disease. So those are ones who continue to teach me.
Yes, absolutely. Well, thank you both so much for joining me today. I sincerely appreciate it.
Thank you for helping us.
Yeah, pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.